outrageous claim. They were 100 miles inland, and there was no record of these mountains ever connecting to any cave system that flowed to the ocean itself. To do so, they'd have to go northward through this range, then veer westward at the Cambrian Mountains, and sail beneath them right to the coast.
And I suppose they told you that?
Lorcan's face was hard as granite.
Watch it,
Rowan snarled. Fenris indeed bared his teeth at the dark-haired warrior, fur bristling. But Aelin said simply,
yes.
Her chin didn't dip an inch. The land above is crawling with soldiers and spies. Going beneath them is the only way. Elide stepped forward.
I will go.
She cut a cold glance toward Lorcan.
You can take your chances above, if you're so disbelieving.
Lorcan's jaw tightened, and a small part of Rowan relished seeing the delicate Lady of Peranth fillet the centuries hardened warrior with a few words.
Considering the potential pitfalls of the situation is wise.
We don't have time to consider,
Rowan cut in, before Elide could voice the retort on her tongue.
We need to keep moving.
Gavriel stalked forward to study the moored boat and what seemed to be bundles of supplies on its sturdy planks.
How will we navigate our way, though?
We'll be escorted,
Aelin answered.
And if they abandon us?
Lorcan challenged. Aelin leveled unfazed eyes upon him.
Then you'll have to find a way out, I suppose.
A hint, just a spark of temper belied those calm words. There was nothing else to debate after that, and they had little to pack. The others gave Aelin privacy to dress by the fire while they inspected the boat. And when his mate emerged again, clad in boots, pants, and various layers beneath her gray surcoat, the sight of her in clothes from Mistward was enough to make his gut clench. No longer a naked escaped captive. Yet none of that wickedness, that joy and unchecked wildness illuminated her face. The rest of their party waited on the boat, seated on the benches built into its high-lipped sides. Fenris and Elide both sat as seemingly far from Lorcan as they could get, Gavriel a golden, long-suffering buffer between them. Rowan lingered at the shore's edge, a hand extended for Aelin while she approached.
Each of her steps seemed considered, as if she still marveled at being able to move freely,
as if still adjusting to her legs without the burden of chains.
Why?
Lorcan mused aloud, more to himself.
Why go to these lengths for us?
He got his answer. They all did, a heartbeat later. Aelin halted a few feet away from the boat and Rowan's outstretched hand. She turned back toward the cave itself. The little folk peeked from those birch branches, from the rocks, from behind stalagmites. Slowly, deeply, Aelin bowed to them. Rowan could have sworn all those tiny heads lowered in answer. A pair of bony, grayish hands rose above a nearby rock, something glittering held between them, and set the object on the stone. Rowan went still. A crown of silver and pearl and diamond gleamed there, fashioned into upswept swan's wings.
The crown of Mab,
Gavriel breathed. But Fenris looked away, toward the looming dark, his tail curling around him. Aelin staggered a step closer to the crown.
It fell into the river.
Rowan didn't want to know how she'd encountered it, why she'd seen it fall into a river. Maeve had kept her sister's two crowns under constant guard, only bringing them out to be displayed in her throne room on state occasions. In memory of her siblings, she'd intoned. Rowan had sometimes wondered if it was a reminder that she had outlasted them, had kept the throne for herself in the end. The grayish hand slipped over the rock's edge again and nudged the crown in silent gesture.
Take it.
You want to know why?
Gavriel softly asked Lorcan as Aelin strode for the rock, nothing but solemn reverence on her face.
Because she is not only Brannan's heir, but Mab's, too.
A throwback to her great-great-grandmother, Maeve had taunted her, who had inherited her strength, her immortal lifespan. Aelin's fingers closed around the crown, lifting it gently. It sparkled like living moonlight between her hands. My sister Mab's line ran true, Elide claimed Maeve had said on the beach. In every way, it seemed. But Aelin made no move to don the crown while she approached him once more, her gait steadier this time. Trying not to dwell on the unbearable smoothness of her hand as it wrapped around his. Rowan helped her aboard, then climbed in himself before freeing the ropes tethering them to the shore. Gavriel went on, awe in every word.
And that makes her their queen, too.
Aelin met Gavriel's gaze, the crown near glowing in her hands.
Yes,
was all she said, as the boat sailed into the darkness. Chapter 36.
How long will it take to reach the coast?
Elide's whisper echoed off the river-carved cavern walls. She'd panicked when the boat had ventured beyond the glow of the shore, and into a passageway across the lake, so dark she couldn't see her own hands before her face. To be trapped in such impenetrable dark for hours, days, possibly longer? Had it been like that in the iron coffin? Aelin gave no indication that the smothering dark bothered her, and had shown no inclination to illuminate their way. Hadn't even summoned an ember. But the little folk, it seemed, had come prepared. And within heartbeats of entering the pitch-black river passage, blue light had kindled on a lantern dangling over the curved prow. Not light, not even magic, but small worms that glowed pale blue, as if they'd each swallowed the heart of a star. They'd been gathered into the lantern, and their soft light rippled over the water-smooth walls. A gentle, soothing light. At least, for her it was so. The fey males sat alert, eyes gleaming with animalistic brightness, using the illumination to mark the caverns they were tugged down by those strange, serpentine beasts.
We're not traveling swiftly,
Rowan answered from where he sat beside Aelin near the back of the boat, Fenris dozing at the queen's feet. It was large enough for each of them to lie down amongst the benches, or gather near the prow to eat the stockpile of fruits and cheeses.
And we don't know how directly these passageways flow. Several days might be a conservative guess.
It would take 3 weeks on foot if we were above,
Gavriel explained, his golden hair silvered by the lantern's light.
Perhaps longer.
Elide fiddled with the ring on her finger, twisting the band around and around. She'd rather travel for a month on foot than remain trapped in these dark, airless passages. But they had no choice. Aneth had not whispered in warning, had not said anything at all before they'd climbed into this boat. Before Aelin had been given an ancient fairy queen's crown, her birthright and heritage. The queen had stashed Mab's crown in one of their packs, as if it were no more than an extra sword belt. She hadn't spoken, and they had not asked her any questions either. Instead, she'd spent these past few hours sitting in the back of the boat, studying her unmarked hands, occasionally peering into the black waters beneath them. What she expected to see beyond her own rippling reflection? Elide didn't want to know. The fell and ancient creatures of these lands were too numerous to count, and most not friendly toward mortals. Leaning against their pile of packs, Elide glanced to her left. Lorcan had positioned himself there, along the edge of the boat, closer to her than he'd sat in weeks. Sensing her attention, his dark eyes slid to her. For long heartbeats, she let herself look at him. He'd crawled after Maeve on the beach to save Aelin, and he had found her during her escape, had ensured Aelin made it out. Did it wipe away what he'd done in summoning Maeve in the first place? Even if Maeve had set the trap, even if he hadn't known what Maeve intended for Aelin, did it erase his decision to call for her? The last time they'd spoken as friends, it had been aboard that ship in the hours before Maeve's armada had arrived. He told her they'd needed to talk, and she'd assumed it was about their future, about them. But perhaps he'd been about to tell her what he'd done, that he'd been wrong in acting before Aelin's plans played out. Elide stopped twisting the ring. He'd done it for her. She knew it. He'd summoned Maeve's armada because he'd believed they were about to be destroyed by Melisande's fleet. He'd done it for her. Just as he'd dropped the shield around them that day Fenris had ripped a chunk out of her arm in exchange for Gavriel's healing her. But the queen sitting silently behind them. No trace of that sharp-edged fire to be seen, nor that wicked grin she'd flashed at all who crossed her path. 2 months with a sadist. With 2 sadists. That had been the cost, and the burden that Aelin and all of them would bear. That silence, that banked fire was because of him. Not entirely, but in some ways. Lorkin's mouth tightened, as if he read the thoughts on her face. Elide looked ahead again, to where the cavern ceiling dipped so low she could have touched it if she stood. The space squeezed tighter and tighter.
It's likely a pass-through to a larger cavern,
Lorkin murmured, as if he could see that fear on her face too, or sent it. Elide didn't bother responding, but she couldn't help the flicker of gratitude. They continued on into the ancient, silent darkness, and no one spoke for a while after that. The caller had not been real, but the army Maeve had summoned was. And Dorian, Manon with him, was in pursuit of the final word key. Should he attain it from Erewhon himself, wherever the Volg King stored it? Should he gain possession of all 3? The lapping of the river against their boat was the only sound. Had been the only sound for a while. Gavriel kept his watch at the prow, Lorkin monitoring from the starboard side, his jaw tight. Fenris and Elide dozed, the lady's head leaning against his flank, inky black hair spilling over a coat of whitest snow. Aelin glanced to Rowan, seated beside her but not touching, her fingers curled in her lap. A blink into the gloom was the only indication that he was aware of her every movement. Aelin breathed in his scent, let its strength settle into her a bit deeper. Dorian and Manon might be anywhere. To hunt for the witch and king would be a fool's errand. Their paths would meet again, or they would not. And if he found the final key and then brought it to her, she would pay what the gods demanded, what she owed Terrasen, the world. Yet if Dorian chose to end it himself, to forge the lock, her stomach churned. He had the power, as much as she did, if not more so. It was meant to be her sacrifice, her bloodshed to save them all, to let him claim it. She could. She must. With Erewhon no doubt unleashing himself on Terrasen, with Maeve's army likely to cause them untold grief. She could let Dorian do this. She trusted him, even if she might never forgive herself for it. Her debt. It was supposed to have been her debt to pay. Perhaps the punishment for failing to do so would be having to live with herself. Having to live with all that had been done to her these months, too. The blackness of the subterranean river pressed in, wrapped its arms around her and squeezed. Different from the blackness of the iron box, the darkness she'd found inside herself. A place she might never escape. Not really. Her power stirred, awakening. Aelin swallowed, refusing to acknowledge it, heed it. She wouldn't. Couldn't. Not yet. Until she was ready. She had seen Rowan's face when she spoke of what his deception with the caller had prompted her to do. Had noted the way her companions looked at her, pity and fear in their eyes. At what had been done to her. What she'd become. A new body. A foreign, strange body, as if she'd been ripped from one and shoved into another. Different from moving between her forms, somehow. She hadn't tried shifting into her human body yet. Didn't see the point. Sitting in silence as the boat was pulled through the gloom, she felt the weight of those stares, their dread. Felt them wondering just how broken she was.
You do not yield.
She knew that had been true, that it had been her mother's voice who had spoken and none other. So she would not yield to this, what had been done, what remained. For the companions around her, to lift their despair, their fear, she wouldn't yield. She'd fight for it, claw her way back to it, who she'd been before. Remembered a swagger and grin and wink. She'd fight against that lingering stain on her soul, fight to ignore it. Would use this journey into the dark to piece herself back together. Just enough to make it convincing. Even if this fractured darkness now dwelled within her. Even if speech was difficult. She would show them what they wished to see. An unbroken firebringer. Aelin of the wildfire. She would show the world that lie as well. Make them believe it. Maybe she'd one day believe it, too. Chapter 37. Days of near-silent travel passed. 3 days, if whatever senses Rowan and Gavriel possessed proved true. Perhaps the latter carried a pocket watch. Aelin didn't particularly care. She used each of those days to consider what had been done, what lay before her. Sometimes the roar of her magic drowned out her thoughts. Sometimes it slumbered. She never heeded it. They sailed through the darkness, the river below so black that they might as well have been drifting through Hellas's realm. It was near the end of the 4th day through the dark and rock, their escorts hauling the boat tirelessly, that Rowan murmured,
"We're entering Barrow-White territory."
Gavriel twisted from his spot by the prow.
"How can you tell?"
Sprawled beside him, still in wolf form, Fenris cocked his ears forward. She hadn't asked him why he remained in his wolf's body. No one asked her why she remained in her fey form, after all. But she supposed that if he donned his fey form, he might feel inclined to talk. To answer questions that he was perhaps not yet ready to discuss. Might begin simply screaming and screaming at what had been done to them. To Connell. Rowan pointed with a tattooed finger toward an alcove in the wall. Shadow veiled its recesses, but as the blue light of the lantern touched it, gold glittered along the rocky floor. Ancient gold.
"What's a Barrow-White?"
Elide whispered.
"Creatures of malice and thought,"
Lorcan answered, scanning the passageway, a hand drifting to the hilt of his sword.
"They covet gold and treasure, and infested the ancient tombs of kings and queens so they might dwell amongst it. They hate light of any kind. Hopefully this will keep them away."
Elide cringed, and Aelin felt inclined to do the same. Instead, she dredged up enough speech to ask Rowan,
"Are these the same ones beneath the burial mounds we visited?"
Rowan straightened, eyes sparking at her question. Or at the fact that she'd spoken at all. He kept by her these days, a silent, steady presence. Even when they'd slept, he'd remained a few feet away, still not touching, but just there. Close enough that the pine and snow scent of him eased her into slumber. Rowan braced a hand along the boat's rim.
"There are many Barrow-White mounds across Wendland, but no others between the Cambrians and Doranel beyond those we went to. As far as we know,"
he amended.
"I didn't realize their tombs had been carved so deep."
"The Whites needed some way in, with the tomb doors likely sealed above,"
Gavriel observed, studying a larger alcove that appeared on the right ahead. Not an alcove, but a dry cave mouth that flowed to the edge of the river before rising out of sight.
"Stop the boat,"
Aelin said. Silence at the order, even from Rowan. Aelin pointed to the lip of the shore by the cave mouth.
"Stop the boat,"
she repeated. I don't think we can, Elide murmured.
Indeed, the two of them had resorted to using a bucket to see to their needs these few days, the males engaging in whatever conversation they could to make the silence more bearable. But the boat headed for the alcove, its speed banking.
Fenris eased to his feet, sniffing the air as they neared the shore ledge.
Rowan and Lorcan leaned out to brace their hands against the stone to keep them from colliding too hard. Aelin didn't wait for the boat to cease rocking before she grabbed a lantern and leaped onto the river's smooth ground. Rowan swore, jumping after her.
Stay here,
he warned whoever remained on the boat. Aelin didn't bother to see who obeyed as she strode into the cave. The queen had been reckless before Cairn and Maeve had worked on her for 2 months, but it seemed she'd had any bit of common sense flayed from her. Lorcan refrained from saying that, though, as he found himself and Elide alone in the boat. Gavriel and Fenris had gone after Rowan and Aelin, their path marked only by the fading gleam of blue light on the walls. Not firelight. She hadn't shown an ember since they'd entered the cave. Elide remained sitting across from him on the left side of the boat, her back resting along the curved edge. She had been silent these past few minutes, watching the now dark cave mouth.
Barrow-wights are nothing to fear if you're armed with magic,
Lorcan found himself saying. Her dark eyes slid to him.
Well, I don't have any, so forgive me if I remain alert.
No. She'd once told him that while magic flowed in the Lochan bloodline, she had none to speak of. He'd never told her that he'd always considered her cleverness to be a mighty magic on its own, regardless of Aneth's whisperings. Elide went on.
It's not the wights I'm worried about.
Lorcan assessed the quiet river flowing by, the caves around them, before he said,
It will take time for her to readjust.
She stared at him with those damning eyes. He braced his forearms on his knees.
We got her back. She's with us now. What more do you want?
From me, he didn't need to add. Elide straightened. I don't want anything.
From you.
He clenched his teeth.
This was where they'd have it out, then. How much longer am I supposed to atone?
Are you growing bored with it?
He snarled. She only glared at him.
I hadn't realized you were even atoning.
I came here, didn't I?
For whom exactly? Rowan? Aelin?
For both of them. And for you.
There. Let it be laid before them. Despite the blue glow of the lantern, he could make out the pink that spread across her cheeks. Yet her mouth tightened.
I told you on that beach.
I want nothing to do with you.
So one mistake and I'm your eternal enemy?
She is my queen, and you summoned Maeve, then told her where the keys were, and you stood there while they did that to her.
You have no idea what the Blood Oath can do. None.
Fenris broke the oath. He found a way.
And had Aelin not been there to offer him another, he would have died.
He let out a low, joyless laugh.
Perhaps that's what you would have preferred.
She ignored his last comment.
You didn't even try.
I did,
he snarled.
I fought it with everything I had, and it was not enough. If she'd ordered me to slit your throat, I would have, and if I had found a way to break the oath, I would have died, and she might very well have killed you or taken you afterward. On that beach, my only thought was to get Maeve to forget about you, to let you go.
I don't care about me. I didn't care about me on that beach.
Well, I do.
His growled words echoed across the water in stone, and he lowered his voice. Worse things than whites might come sniffing down here.
I cared about you on that beach. And your queen did, too.
Elide shook her head and looked away. Looked anywhere, it seemed, but at him. This was what came of opening that door to a place inside him that no one had ever breached. This mess,
this hollowness in his chest that made him keep needing to make things right.
Resent me all you like,
he said, damning the hoarseness of his words.
I'm sure I'll survive.
Hurt flashed in her eyes. Fine, she said, her voice brittle. He hated that brittleness more than anything he'd ever encountered. Hated himself for causing it. But he had limits to how low he'd crawl. He'd said his piece. If she wanted to wash her hands of him forever, then he would find a way to respect that. Live with it. Somehow. The cave ascended for a few feet, then leveled out and wended into the stone. A rough-hewn passage carved not by water or age, Rowan realized, but by mortal hands. Perhaps the long-dead kings and lords had taken the subterranean river to deposit their dead, before sealing the tombs to sunlight and air above, the knowledge of the pathways dying off with their kingdoms. A faint glow pulsed from the lantern Aelin held, bathing the cave walls in blue. He'd quickly caught up to her, and now strode at her side, Fenris trotting at her heels and Gavriel taking up the rear. Rowan hadn't bothered to free his weapons. Steel was of little use against the whites. Only magic might destroy them. Why Aelin had needed to stop, what she'd needed to see, he could only guess as the passage opened into a small cavern and gold gleamed. Gold all around, and a shadow clothed in tattered black robes lurking by the sarcophagus in the center. Rowan snarled in warning, but Aelin didn't strike. Her hand curled at her side, but she remained still. The white hissed. Aelin just watched it, as if she wouldn't, couldn't touch her power. Rowan's chest strained. Then he sent a whip of ice and wind through the cave. The white shrieked once and was gone. Aelin stared at where it had been for a heartbeat, then glanced at him over a shoulder. Gratitude shone in her eyes. Rowan only gave her a nod. Don't worry about it. Yet Aelin turned away, shutting off that silent conversation as she surveyed the space. Time. It would take time for her to heal, even if he knew his fire heart would pretend otherwise. So Rowan looked too. Across the tomb, beyond the sarcophagus and treasure, an archway opened into another chamber. Perhaps another tomb, or an exit passage.
We don't have time to find a way out, Rowan murmured, as she strode into the tomb. And the caves remain safer than the surface.
I'm not looking for a way out, she said in that calm, unmoved voice. She stooped, swiping up a fistful of gold coins stamped with a forgotten king's face. We're going to need to fund our travels, and the gods know what else. Rowan arched a brow. Aelin shrugged and shoved the gold into the pocket of her cloak. Unless the pitiful clinking I heard from your coin purse didn't indicate you were low on funds. That spark of wry humor. The taunting. She was trying. For his sake or the others, maybe her own. She was trying. He could offer her nothing less, too. Rowan inclined his head.
We are indeed in dire need of replenishing our coffers.
Gavriel coughed.
This does belong to the dead, you know.
Aelin added another fistful of coins to her pocket, beginning a circuit around the treasure-laden tomb. The dead don't need to buy passage on a ship. Or horses. Rowan gave the lion a slashing grin.
You heard the lady.
A flash ruptured from where Fenris had been sniffing at a trunk of jewels. And then a male was standing there. His gray clothes worn, but intact. In better shape than the hollowed-out look in his eyes. Aelin paused her looting. Fenris's throat bobbed, as if trying to remember speech. Then he said hoarsely,
We needed more pockets.
He patted his own for emphasis. Aelin's lips curved in a hint of a smile. She blinked at Fenris, 3 times. Fenris blinked once in answer. A code. They'd made up some silent code to communicate when he'd been ordered to remain in his wolf form. Aelin's smile remained, just barely, as she walked to the golden-haired male, his bronze skin ashen. She opened her arms in silent offer, to let him decide if he wished for contact, if he could endure it, just as Rowan would let her decide if she wished to touch him. A small sigh broke from Fenris before he folded Aelin into his arms, a shudder rippling through him. Rowan couldn't see her face, perhaps didn't need to, as her hands gripped Fenris's jacket so tightly they were white-knuckled. A good sign, a small miracle, that either of them wished could be touched. Rowan reminded himself of it, even while some intrinsic male part of him tensed at the contact. A territorial fey bastard, she'd once called him. He'd do his best not to live up to that title.
Thank you,
Aelin said, her voice small in a way that made Rowan's chest crack further. Fenris didn't answer, but from the anguish on his face, Rowan knew no thanks were in order. They pulled away, and Fenris cupped her cheek.
When you are ready, we can talk.
About what they'd endured, to unravel all that had happened. Aelin nodded, blowing out a breath.
Likewise.
She resumed shoving gold into her pockets, but glanced back to Fenris, his face drawn.
I gave you the blood oath to save your life, she said. But if you do not want it, Fenris, we can find some way to free you.
I want it,
Fenris said. No trace of his usual swaggering humor. He glanced to Rowan and bowed his head.
It is my honor to serve this court. And serve you,
he added to Aelin. She waved a hand in dismissal, though Rowan didn't fail to note the sheen in her eyes as she stooped to gather more gold. Giving her a moment, he strode to Fenris and clasped his shoulder.
It's good to have you back,
he added. Stumbling a bit on the word,
brother.
For that's what they would be. Had never been before, but what Fenris had done for Aelin? Yes, brother was what Rowan would call him, even if Fenris's own. Fenris's dark eyes flickered.
She killed Connell, made him stab himself in the heart.
A pearl and ruby necklace scattered from Gavriel's fingers. The temperature in the tomb spiked. But there was no flash of flame, no swirl of embers. As if Aelin's magic had surged only to be leashed again. Yet Aelin continued shoving gold and jewels into her pockets.
She'd witnessed it too, that slaughter.
But it was Gavriel, approaching on silent feet even with the jewels and gold on the floor, who clasped Fenris's other shoulder.
We will make sure that debt is paid before the end.
The lion had never uttered such words, not toward their former queen. But fury burned in Gavriel's tawny gaze. Sorrow and fury. Fenris took a steadying breath and stepped away, the loss on his face mingling with something Rowan couldn't place. But now wasn't the time to ask, to pry. They filled their pockets with as much gold as they could fit, Fenris going so far as to remove his gray jacket to form a makeshift pack. When it was nearly drooping to the floor with gold, the thread straining, he silently headed back down the passageway. Gavriel, still wincing at their shameless looting, stalked after him a moment later. Aelin continued picking her way amongst the treasure, however. She'd been more selective than the rest of them, examining pieces with what Rowan had assumed was a jeweler's eye. The gods knew she'd owned enough finery to tell what would fetch the highest price at market.
We should go, he said.
His own pockets were near to bursting, his every step weighed down. She rose from a rusted metal chest she'd been riffling through. Rowan remained still as she approached, something clenched in her palm. It was only when she stopped close enough for him to touch her that she unfurled her fingers. Two golden rings lay there.
I don't know the fey customs, she said.
The thicker ring held an elegantly cut ruby within the band itself, while the smaller one bore a sparkling rectangular emerald mounted atop, the stone as large as her fingernail. But when humans wed, rings are exchanged. Her fingers trembled, just slightly. Too many unspoken words lay between them. Yet now was not the time for that conversation, for that healing. Not when they had to be on their way as swiftly as possible. And this offer she'd made him, this proof that she still wanted what lay between them, the vows they'd sworn.
I assume the sparkly emerald is for me,
Rowan said with a half smile. She huffed a laugh. The soft, whispered sound was as precious as the rings she'd found for them in this hoard. She took his hand, and he tried not to shudder in relief, tried not to fall to his knees as she slid the ruby ring onto his finger. It fit him perfectly, the ring no doubt forged for the king lying in this barrow. Silently, Rowan grasped her own hand and eased on the emerald ring.
To whatever end,
he whispered. Silver lined her eyes.
To whatever end.
A reminder and a vow, more sacred than the wedding oaths they'd sworn on that ship. To walk this path together, back from the darkness of the iron coffin. To face what waited in Terrasen, ancient promises to the gods be damned. He ran his thumb over the back of her hand.
I'll make the tattoo again.
She swallowed, but nodded.
And,
he added,
I'd like to add another. To me and to you.
Her brows flicked up, but he squeezed her hand.
You'll have to wait and see, princess.
Another hint of a smile. She didn't balk from the silent words this time. Typical. He opened his mouth to voice the question he'd been dying to ask for days now.
May I kiss you?
But she pulled her hand from his, admiring the wedding band sparkling on her finger. Her mouth tightened as she turned over her palm. I'll need to retrain. Not a single callus marked her hands. Aelin frowned at her too thin body. And pack on some muscle again. A slight quiver graced her words, but she curled her hands into fists at her sides and smirked at her clothes. The mistward clothes. It'll be just like old times. Trying. She was dredging up that swagger and trying. So he would too. Until she didn't need to anymore. Rowan gave her a crooked grin.
Just like old times,
he said, following her out of the barrow and back toward the Ebony River, but with far less sleep. He could have sworn the passageway heated, but Aelin kept going. Later, that conversation, this unfinished business between them, would come later. Chapter 38. The queen and her consort needed a private moment, it seemed. Elide had been more surprised to see Fenris in his beautiful male form than the gold that he and Gavriel bore, near spilling out of their pockets. Lorkin laughed softly as they packed the treasure into their bags. More than some people could dream of.
At least she's thinking one step ahead.
Fenris stilled where he crouched before his bag, the gold in his hands shimmering like his hair. There was nothing remotely warm in his dark eyes. We're only in this position because of you. Elide tensed as Lorkin stiffened. Gavriel halted his packing, a hand drifting to the dagger at his side. But the dark-haired warrior inclined his head.
So I have been reminded,
he said, but didn't glance to Elide. Fenris bared his teeth.
When we're out of this,
he hissed.
You and I will settle things.
Lorkin's smile was a brutal slash of white.
It shall be my pleasure.
Elide knew he meant it. He'd be glad to take on whatever Fenris threw his way, to engage in that devastating, bloody conflict. Gavriel let out a sigh, his tawny eyes meeting Elide's. Nothing could be said or done to convince them otherwise. Yet Elide found herself drawing in breath to suggest that fighting amongst each other, vengeance or no, wouldn't be fulfilling. When Aelin and Rowan emerged from the passage, Goldrin hung at the queen's side, undoubtedly given back to her by the prince. Its glittering ruby looked like an amethyst in the blue lantern light, bobbing with each of Aelin's steps. They'd barely stepped onto the boat when a hissing flitted from the passage they'd vacated. Tensing, Rowan and Gavriel swiftly shoved the boat from the shore. The creatures tugging them along lurched into motion, pulling them farther into the river. Blades gleamed, all the immortal warriors deathly still. Aelin didn't draw Goldrin, though, didn't lift a burning hand. She merely lingered by a lead, her face like stone. The hissing grew louder. Shadowed, scabbed hands clawed at the passage archway, recoiling wherever they met the light.
Someone's pissed about the treasure,
Fenris muttered.
They can get in line,
Aelin said, and Elide could have sworn that the gold in the queen's eyes glowed. A flare of deep hidden light, then nothing. An ice-kissed wind snapped through the caves. The hissing stopped. Shuddering, Elide murmured,
I don't think I should care to return to these lands.
Fenris chuckled, a sensuous laugh that didn't meet his eyes.
I agree with you, lady.
They drifted into the blackness for another day, then two. Still, the sea did not appear. Aelin was sleeping, a dreamless, heavy slumber, when a strong hand clasped her shoulder.
Look,
Rowan whispered, his breath brushing her ear. She opened her eyes to pale light. Not the ocean, she realized as she sat up, the others rousing, undoubtedly at Rowan's word. Overhead, clinging to the cavern ceiling as if they were stars trapped beneath the rock, small blue lights glowed. Glowworms, like those in the lantern. Thousands of them, made infinite by the reflection in the black water. Stars above and below. From the corner of her eye, Aelin glimpsed Elide press a hand to her chest. A sea of stars. That's what the cave had become. Beauty. There was still beauty in this world. Stars could still glow, still burn bright, even buried under the earth. Aelin breathed in the cool cave air, the blue light. Let it flow through her. Rattle the stars. She'd promised to do that. Had done so much toward it, yet more remained. They had to hurry. How many suffered at Morath's claws? Beauty remained. And she would fight for it. Needed to fight. It was a constant thrum in her blood, her bones. Right alongside the power that she shoved down deep and dismissed with each breath. Fight. One last time. She'd escaped, so she might do it. Would think of all those still defying Morath, defying Maeve, while she trained. She wouldn't hesitate, didn't dare to pause. She'd make this time count, in every way possible. The emerald on her marriage band glistened with its own fire. Selfish of her, to enforce that bond when her very blood destined her for a sacrificial altar. And yet she had gotten out of the boat to find them. The rings. Raiding the trove had been an afterthought. But if she was to have no scars on her, no reminder of where she'd been and who she was and what she'd promised, then she'd needed this one scrap of proof. Aelin could have sworn the living stars overhead sang, a celestial choir that floated through the caves. A star song, carried along the river current, running beside them. For the last miles to the sea. Chapter 39. The enemy's army arrived not in 3 days, or four, but five. A blessing and a curse, Nezrin decided. A blessing for the time it granted them to prepare. For the Rooks to carry some of the most vulnerable of Aniel's people to a snow-blasted camp beyond the Fangs. And a curse for the fear it allowed to fester in the keep, now teeming with those who would not or could not make the journey. By sunset on the fourth day, They could see the black lines marching for them through the swaths of Oakwald that they hewed down. By dawn on the fifth day, they were near the outskirts of the lake, the plain. Nezrin sat atop Salki on one of the keep's spires, Borte on Arcus beside her.
For a demon army, they march slower than my edge's own mother.
Nezrin snorted. Armies have supply trains, and this one had a river to cross and a forest to fell. Borte sniffed.
Seems like an awful lot of trouble for such a small city.
Indeed, the Rook Riders had not been impressed by Aniel, certainly not after camping in Antica before their passage to these lands. Save this city, take the Farian Gap to the north of it, and we could clear a path northward. It might be an ugly place, but it's vital.
Oh, the land is beautiful, Borte said,
gazing toward the lake sparkling under the winter light, steam from the nearby hot springs drifting across its surface.
But the buildings?
She made a face. Nezrin chuckled. You may be right. For a few moments, they watched the army creep closer. People were fleeing in the streets now, rushing up the keep's endless steps and battlements.
I'm surprised Sartak will let his future empress fly against them,
Borte said slyly. The girl had relentlessly teased her these weeks. Nezrin scowled. Where's Yeren?
Borte stuck out her tongue, despite the army inching toward them. Burning in hell, for all I care?
Even away from their respective Ares and ancient rivalries, the betrothed pair had not warmed to each other. Or perhaps it was part of the game the two of them played, had been playing for years now. To feign loathing when it was so clear they'd slaughter anyone who posed a threat to the other.
Nezrin lifted her brows, and Borte crossed her arms, her twin braids blowing in the wind. He's bringing the last two healers to the keep.
Indeed, a near black rook flapped up from the plain. No inclination to finally wed before the battle.
Borte recoiled. Why would I?
Nezrin smirked. So you might have your wedding night?
Borte barked a laugh. Who says I haven't already?
Nezrin gaped. But Borte only inclined her head, clicking her tongue at Arcus, and Ryder and Rook dove into the brisk sky. Nezrin stared after Borte until she'd reached the plain, passing by Yeren and his Rook in a daring maneuver that some might have interpreted to be a giant, vulgar gesture to the warrior. Yeren's dark Rook screeched in outrage, and Nezrin smiled, knowing Yeren was likely doing the same, even with the two healers riding with him. Yet Nezrin's smile proved short-lived as she again beheld the marching army nearer and nearer with each minute. An unbroken, untiring mass of steel and death. Would they camp until dawn? Or attack at nightfall? Would the siege be quick and lethal, or long and brutal? She'd seen their supply trains. They were prepared to stay for as long as it took to bring this city to rubble and wipe out every soul dwelling within. The bone drums began at sundown. Irene stood on the highest parapet of the keep, counting the torches sprawling into the night, and fought to keep her dinner down. It was no different from the other meals she'd eaten today, she told herself, the meals she had struggled to consume without gagging. The parapet was filled with soldiers and onlookers alike, all gazing toward the army at the border of the plain that separated them from the city's edge, all listening in hushed silence to the relentless drumming. A steady, horrible beat, meant to unnerve, to break one's will. She knew they'd continue all night, deprive them of rest, make them dread the dawn. The keep was as full as it could stand, hallways crammed with bedrolls. She and Kaol had yielded their room to a family of five, the children too young to make the trip to the wastes, even on a rook's back. In the frigid air, an infant might go blue with cold in minutes. Irene ran a hand over the waist-high stone wall. Thick, ancient stone. She beseeched it to hold out. Catapults. There were catapults in the army below. She'd heard Falcon's latest report at breakfast. The plain itself was still littered with enough boulders from the days it had been a part of the lake that Morath would have no problem finding things to hurl at them. The warning had kept Irene busy all day, relocating families who had taken rooms on the lake side of the keep, or those who slept too close to windows or outer walls. Last minute, and foolish not to consider it before now. But she'd been so focused these past 5 days on getting everyone in that she hadn't thought of things like catapults and shattering blocks of heavy stone. She'd moved their healing supplies, too, to an inner chamber where it would take the entire keep collapsing to destroy what was inside. The Torre healers had brought what they could from the fleet, but they'd made more when they arrived. Not their best work, not by any means. But Arisha had ordered that the salves and tonics need only to function, not dazzle, and to keep mixing. All was set. All was ready. Or as ready as they might ever be. So Irene lingered on the battlements, listening to the bone drums for a while longer. Kaol told himself it was not his last night with his wife. He'd still made the best of it, and they had rested as much as they could stand before they were up, hours before dawn. The rest of the keep was awake, too. The rooks restless on the tower roofs and battlements, the click and scrape of their talons on the stones echoing in every hall and chamber. The drums kept pounding, had pounded all night. He'd kissed Irene goodbye, and she'd seemed like she wanted to say more but had opted to hold him for a long, precious minute before they parted ways. It would not be the last time he saw her, he promised himself, as he aimed for the battlements where his father, Sartak, and Nezrin had agreed to meet at dawn. The prince and Nezrin had not yet arrived, but his father stood in armor Kaol had not glimpsed since childhood, since his father had ridden to serve Otterlin's wishes, to conquer this continent. It still fit him well, the muted metal scratched and dented. Not the finest piece of armor from the family arsenal beneath the keep, but the sturdiest. A sword hung at his hip, and a shield lay against the battlement wall. Around them, sentries tried not to watch, though their fear-wide eyes tracked every movement. The drums pounded on. Kaol came up beside his father, his own dark tunic reinforced with armor at his shoulders, forearms, and shins. A cane of ironwood had been sheathed down Kaol's back, for when Irene's magic began to fade, and his chair waited just inside the great hall for when her power depleted entirely. What his father had made of it when Kaol had explained yesterday, he hadn't let on. Hadn't said a single word. Kaol cast a sidelong glance at the man staring toward the army, whose fires began winking out one by one under the rising light.
They used the bone drums during the last siege of Aniel,
his father said, not a tremor in his voice.
Legend says they beat the drums for 3 days and 3 nights before they attacked, and that the city was so rife with terror, so mad with sleeplessness, that they didn't stand a chance. Erewhon's armies and beasts shredded them apart. They did not have rooks fighting with them then, Kaol said. We'll see how long they last.
Kaol gritted his teeth.
If you do not have hope, then your men will not last long either.
His father stared toward the plain, the army revealed with each minute.
Your mother left,
the man said at last. Kaol didn't hide his shock. His father gripped the stone parapet.
She took Terran and left. I don't know where they fled. As soon as we realized we'd been surrounded by enemies, she took her ladies-in-waiting, their families, departed in the dead of night. Only your brother bothered to leave a note.
His mother, after all she'd endured, all she'd survived in this hellish house, had finally walked out. To save her other son, their promise of a future.
What did Terran say?
His father smoothed his hand over the stone.
It doesn't matter.
It clearly did, but now wasn't the time to push, to care. There was no fear on his father's face, just cold resignation.
If you do not lead these men today,
Kaol growled,
then I will.
His father looked at him at last, his face grave.
Your wife is pregnant.
The shock roiled through Kaol like a physical blow. Irene.
A skilled healer she might be, but a deft liar she is not. Or have you not noticed her hand frequently resting on her stomach? Or how green she turns at mealtime?
Such mild, casual words. As if his father weren't ripping the ground out from beneath him. Kaol opened his mouth, body tensing. To yell at his father? To run to Irene? He didn't know. But then the bone drums stopped. And the army began to advance. Chapter 40 Manon and the 13 had buried each and every one of the soldiers massacred by the Iron Teeth. Their torn and bleeding hands throbbed, their backs ached, but they'd done it. When the last of the hard earth had been patted down, she'd found Bronwyn lingering at the edge of the clearing, the rest of the Crokins having moved off to set up camp. The 13 had trudged past Manon. Ghislaine, according to Vesta, had been invited to sit at the hearth of a witch with an equal interest in those mortal scholarly pursuits. Only Asterin remained in the shadows nearby, to guard her back as Manon asked Bronwyn,
What is it?
She should have tried for pleasantries, for diplomacy, but she didn't. Couldn't muster it. Bronwyn's throat bobbed, as if choking on the words.
You and your coven acted honorably.
You doubted it, from the white demon?
I did not think the Iron Teeth bothered to care for human lives.
She didn't know the half of it. Manon only said,
My grandmother informed me that I am no longer an Iron Teeth witch. So it seems who they do or do not care for no longer bears any weight with me.
She kept walking toward the trees where the 13 had vanished, and Bronwyn fell into step beside her.
It was the least I could do,
Manon admitted. Bronwyn glanced at her sidelong.
Indeed.
Manon eyed the Kraken.
You lead your witches well.
The Iron Teeth have long given us an excuse to be highly trained.
Something like shame washed through her again. She wondered if she'd ever find a way to ease it, to endure it.
I suppose we have.
Bronwyn didn't reply before peeling off toward the small fires. But as Manon went in search of Glennis's own hearth, the Crokins looked her way. Some tipped their heads toward her. Some offered grim nods. She saw to it that the 13 were tending to their hands, and found herself unable to sit, to let the weight of the day catch up to her. Around them, around each fire, Crokins argued quietly on whether to return home or head farther south into Eelway. Yet if they went into Eelway, what would they do? Manon barely heard as the debate raged, Glennis letting each of the 7 ruling hearths arrive at its own decision. Manon didn't linger to hear what they chose. Didn't bother to ask them to fly northward. Asterin stalked to Manon's side, offering her a strip of dried rabbit while the 13 ate, the Crokins continuing their quiet debates. The wind sang through the trees, hollow and keening.
Where do we go at dawn?
Asterin asked.
Do we follow them, or head northward?
Did they cling to this increasingly futile quest to win them over? Or did they abandon it? Manon studied her bleeding, aching hands, the iron nails crusted with dirt.
I am a Crokin, she said, and I am an Iron Teeth witch.
She flexed her fingers, willing the stiffness from them.
The Iron Teeth are my people, too, regardless of what my grandmother may decree. They are my people, blue blood and yellow legs and black beak alike.
And she would bear the weight of what she'd created, what she'd trained, forever. Asterin said nothing, though Manon knew she listened to every word, knew the 13 had stopped eating to listen, too.
I want to bring them home,
Manon said to them, to the wind that flowed all the way to the wastes.
I want to bring them all home, before it is too late, before they become something unworthy of a homeland.
So, what are you going to do?
Astrin asked softly, but not weakly. Manon finished the strip of dried meat and swigged from her water skin. The answer did not lie in picking one over the other, Kraken over Iron Teeth. It never had.
If the Krakens will not rally a host, then I'll find another, one already trained.
You cannot go to Morath,
Astrin breathed.
You won't get within 100 miles. The Iron Teeth host might be already too far gone to even consider siding with you.
I'm not going to Morath.
Manon slid her frozen hand into her pocket.
I'm going to the Farian Gap, to whatever of the host remains there under Petra Blueblood's command, to ask them to join us.
Astrin and the 13 had been stunned into silence. Letting them dwell on it, Manon had turned into the trees, had picked up Dorian's scent and followed it, and seen him conversing with the spirit of Caltaine Rompier, the woman healed and lucid in death, freed from her terrible torment. Shock had rooted Manon to the spot.
Then she had heard of Dorian's plans to infiltrate Morath.
Morath, where the third and final word key was kept. He'd known, and hadn't told her. Caltaine had vanished into the night air, and then Dorian had shifted into a beautiful, proud raven. He hadn't been training to entertain himself. Not at all. Manon snarled,
when exactly were you going to inform me that you were about to retrieve the third word key?
Dorian blinked at her, his face the portrait of calm assurance.
When I left. When you flew off as a raven or a wyvern, right into Erewhon's net?
The temperature in the clearing plunged.
What difference does it make if I told you weeks ago or now?